Good morning. So I'm going to be doing exam review today. The way that's going to work is I'm going to take questions you have and talk about them. If you don't ask me something, I'm not going to talk about it. Assume you already know it and you don't need the review of that. So I will just collect the topics in one big round and list them down, and then I'll go through them in some order, and if we end up going through everything I collect in my first round, I'll just do it again and collect some more questions. So what do people want me to talk about? Yes. So ISA versus microarchitecture. Okay. Other questions? Yes. Pipelining, anything more specific? Latency and throughput, okay. Okay.
The operations, the review of the operations.
Operations, oh, bitwise operations. Anything more specific?
Not particularly.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, the HCL register question on the latest quiz, okay. Yeah. What, sorry? Instruction stages, okay. I'll go here and then, yeah.
Had that Piazza answer about how like the bits were kind of switched for accessing the register, like RA,
okay, RA, RB bit indexing, okay. Other, yeah. Timing, meaning. Okay, with a pipeline or without or both? Okay. Pipeline, CPUs, okay. Dynamic linking. Okay. Anything else? Anything not listed? Or would like, yeah. Okay, object files and what?
Relocation.
And relocation. Tables, okay. Any other topics that I'm missing here? Yeah. Which was?
About doubling.
Okay. Doubling stages effect on latency throughput. Quiz. Okay. So let me just try to sort these by sort of groups of related topics. So we've got instruction stages, probably belongs with timing here. Dynamic linking. Well, these belong together. Okay. Okay, so let's start with, I'm doing this roughly in the order we covered it in lecture and trying to keep related things together. So, dynamic linking. So, when we talked about linking, our sort of, dynamic linking only makes sense if you contrast it to our sort of simpler option, which is what we discussed in a lot more detail, which was static linking. So static linking is executable file, contains all the code, all the stuff we load into memory. But this has a disadvantage, so this has a con, which is many copies of common library routines, like printf, for example. So if every application that uses printf, with static linking, we need to copy something from disk into memory, from that executable file. So every executable that uses printf is going to have its own copy of printf that we're going to copy into memory when it starts. And that's not very efficient. We like to save space on disk and ideally in memory by not having lots of copies of printf around. And we'd really like to be able to upgrade our copy of printf, say it has a bug, without having to recompile every single program that uses printf. So our solution is, so linking is instead common library routines, or potentially common, like maybe they're not actually, are loaded when the application starts from another file. So we have our executable file, which has the, so executable file doesn't contain copy of printf, just note about where to get a copy of printf, e.g. read libc.so. So the executable file contains this note, hey, go to this other file to get a copy of that. It loads at runtime. If we update that file, you got a copy. And we mentioned that just briefly, we didn't go into like real details about how dynamic linking works, but we mentioned that often there's extra indirection. I mentioned this mainly so when you saw this on the bomb homework, you wouldn't be surprised that why are we calling a function to call a function? So there's often extra indirection to limit changes to machine code at runtime. And the example is calling printf through a function pointer. Might be the thing you'd do in order to make it so you have to change less machine code depending on how printf gets loaded. But the key, the important part is, you know, this idea that we have these common library routines, we're going to load them separately. And that's going to save us a bunch of space and allow us to easily upgrade those separately, rather than having to reproduce the executable every time we update printf and other similar common routines. Yes?
What does limit changes to machine code
do? So the example is, so if we have, say, 1,000 calls to printf, we don't want to edit 1,000 places in the machine code at load time. So that's the thing we're avoiding. So if we had 1,000 calls to printf, we were doing the naive thing, we'd change each of those calls to point to where we loaded printf. But instead of doing that, they'll often make those calls go to a table of function pointers, and we'll set a function pointer in that table. So alternative, those calls use a table of function pointers. Function pointers at load time set entry in the table. So that's an example of saving that. It's not something you'd have to do. Like, it's still dynamic linking if you edited all those calls, but because you might have tons of calls, it's like would be really expensive if we had to do that as part of loading an application. Fix all of them. And there's other techniques you might use to limit that cost, but like that's a real concern. Yeah.
What is that .so file?
.so is the extension Linux uses for libraries which are loaded in this way, loaded at load time. It stands for shared object. Other OSs will use different extensions. Windows uses .dll for dynamically linked library. OS X uses .dylib, D-Y-L-I-B for dynamic library. So it's not consistent. Okay, so that's dynamic linking. Object files and relocation tables. So in our object file, we have two things. We have data, you know, so I guess I should say bytes, which could be code, machine code, or data to be copied into executable, and information to fix up holes in those bytes. And that information to fix up those holes takes two forms. So we have relocations, which are holes in the current file that need information from elsewhere. The information could just be, where is this going in memory? The information could be, where is the printf function? What object file is that even in? But we need information from elsewhere for those holes. Those are relocations. We also have the symbol table, which is the names of things in this file that might be referenced by relocation. So an example of a relocation is call to printf, which I don't know where it is. So that's something we need to fix before we make the executable, is that there's this call to printf, but we don't know where it's going to be yet. It needs to be fixed. An example of an assemble table is, you know, byte, you know, 1000 of this file is where the function main starts. So this is information we'll use with relocations to figure out how to produce our executable. We need to know where is the main function in order to make an executable. This will tell us that. The symbol table will tell us that kind of information. Okay, so is that questions on what's in object files? No? Everyone's good? Yes.
So is the symbol table also like guided executable where in the libc file?
The question is, does the symbol table guide the executable, the linker, the thing that's making the executable, and where in what file to look? So the symbol table tells the linker is going to, when the linker sees a relocation, like there's a call to printf here, it's going to look at all the symbol tables it knows about to find out where is printf. So in that sense, it guides it. Note that it never looks at anything but the object files. So if the linker needs to do something, it better be in the object file somewhere, the information it needs for that, one of the object files. Other questions? Okay, so that's on object files. Then we had someone just vaguely for bitwise operations. I prefer a more specific question because I think I'm usually guessing wrong about why people are confused about bitwise operations. So we had sort of two big types. We had shifts and we had sort of, which were sort of in this category, and we had bitwise logical operations. So our shifts, we had left shift. So left shift, because I remember which direction things are. Left shift, which is, in arithmetic, we can say this is multiply by power of 2, or in binary, we can say add zeros to the end. If bits go off the front, the most significant side, ignore that. So we might lose some bits in the process. We'll just ignore when that happens. We'll just say those bits go away. We forgot about them because our registers are only so big. Then we had our right shift, where we had two types. Arithmetic shift, arithmetic right shift, which is equivalent to divide by power of 2 is sine divide by power of 2 rounding down. Rounding, that's towards minus infinity. Just to be clear about what I mean by down. Add copies of the sine bit at the beginning, the most significant side. Let bits go off the end, the least significant side, and ignore them. We also had a logical right shift, which was equivalent to unsigned divide by a power of 2, rounding towards minus infinity, but that's the same as rounding towards 0 with unsigned numbers, since we can't have negative numbers, there's no difference. And this is just add zeros to beginning and let bits go off the end. Beginning, this is the most. And we learned that this is typically with signed numbers, including for us, including x86, us. So all the compilers we're using work that way, but it's not technically guaranteed, though I don't think you'll find one which isn't. And this is with unsigned numbers, as far as C. And then we had the bitwise logical operations, which were bit by bit pairs do a single logic gate. So we had AND, one only if both inputs one, or one if any input one, XOR, which was one if exactly one input one was one. Exactly one input was one. And we had ways of thinking about these for using these logically, as far as like I had some tasks to accomplish, that AND is good for keep only certain bits or clear certain bits, where we end, and this is AND with mask, where kept bits are 1. This is AND with mask, where cleared bits are 0. So we choose a mask, namely just a chosen number that has like the bit set in the pattern we want in our final result. Do that for OR, this was set certain bits. And for XOR, it was flip certain bits. And we have the same idea of selecting a mask. And the general sort of pattern I suggest is isolate. So pattern for problems. So is split into subproblems, isolate parts of number with AND plus shifting, typically, to get the parts you care about, and then do whatever operation you want on the parts you isolate and move to the part, usually the bottom, the least significant part of the number, but maybe if you want them at the top, at the end, you'll move them there. And that's sort of the general pattern that we typically follow for our solving our sort of bitwise puzzles. Yes? Towards negative, this is OR. Because it's the same. Rounding towards negative infinity or towards 0, you can look at it either way. Other questions? Yes? So the question is, do you need to know about biasing for proper rounding? Would note on the homework that we mentioned where it was in the textbook. Obviously, we don't expect you to look in the textbook during the exam. So to that extent, no. We expect you to know that you'll not get the right answer if you don't handle that. And we expect you to know, like, if we show you code which did that, to figure out like what results it would give. So we expect that sort of knowledge. I don't think we'll have you whole cloth figure that out, because that's what the homework was for. But certainly we want the general concept to be something you should know, especially since you did the homework. Yes?
What is rounding towards negative?
What I mean by rounding towards negative infinity, that means if I divide by 4 and get 1.7, then I'm going to round in the direction of negative infinity, which means down to 1. If I divide by 4 and get negative 1.7, I'm going to round down towards negative infinity, which means negative 2. Okay. questions on Bitwise things that I'm trying to explain? I'm going through these topics awfully more quickly than I expected. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm going back to the negative infinity. You say negative infinity or zero.
Because with unsigned numbers, so yeah, you know, because always they're always positive. So if we think of number line direction, we're always going, you know, going towards zero or negative infinity. It's the same thing because it's always lower than the number. And I guess I'll give example of, you know, so this means minus 5 over 1 gives us, should give us minus 2.5, which gives us minus 3, but 5 over 1 gives us 2. Other questions?
Can you scroll down a little bit?
Sure.
Can you give an example of the mask?
The
end of the mask. Can you give an example?
So, for example, if I have the binary. You know, let's give a. One, want to extract the bit, and want to extract bits 5 through 3. That's, or 5 through, yeah. So let's say that we're having that this is bit, you know, using this numbering because I have to specify 0, 1, 2, and. So we have 1, 1, 0, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'll do binary 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0. And with the mask equals a number where we have bits 5 through C set, which will be three zeros like this. And so when I do that ending, I get this number, and then I would probably, if I want to move bit, and then if I want to move, you know, next step might be move bits 5 through 3 into bits 0 through 2. So then I would do a shift that over by 3 to do that and get 0, 1, 0 and a bunch of zeros I presumably don't care about before. And that's an example of what that operation looked like written out with binary. Of course, in C or C++, you don't have binary constants, so you probably write hex. But that's sort of doing that. That's the kind of thing we do where if you need to know something about those bits, that's how you extract those that number. So our end of operation is ends up being, and this is equal to, which is hex 8. So you do hex 3 to extract those bits. Yeah. So the mask, this is the number, this is the number with bits 5 through 3, and I'm doing, sorry, inclusive set to 1. And that's because I'm following this rule to keep only the bits where 5 through 3, keep only the bits where that's 1. So I chose that because I choose a number where the bits I wanted were set to 1, so all the other bits would be set to 0. Thank you. services. Like that. Okay. Other questions? No. Okay. So not yet, at least. Okay, so ISA versus microarchitecture. So the instruction set architecture, we can think of as, you know, what you need to know about to write a compiler plus assembler, basically. Yeah. And maybe a linker, because we need to know, like, linker needs to know what to fill in the blanks, but compiler plus assembler. So this is, what instructions are there? What does their machine code look like? It's that kind of information. You know, what types of operands do they take? Do the instructions take? How do are those operands represented in machine code? So it's all the information that the compiler and assembler cares about. As far as producing, this is to, you know, to produce correct working programs. So notably, not in there is anything about producing fast programs. This is not part of the information for producing fast programs. This is what you need to know to produce working programs, all the stuff you could possibly want to know about. How do I make correct programs? What are correct programs for this architecture? All you need to know. All you would ever need to know to do that. So what types of what instructions are there? All the instructions. What does the machine code look like? How do I generate machine code given an instruction? What operands can they take? Which is part of knowing, how do I generate machine code? Are there operands they can't take? So on. What if there's register operands? What are the possible registers? It's all the information that the assembler and compiler might care about. So the assembler needs to know, what are all the possible instructions? Because you have to assemble all of them. And the compiler needs to know what all the instructions do. So that's part of the specification, like to generate correct code. We need to know, what did the instructions actually do as far as, you know, the effects, you know, so instructions are there. What do the instructions do? Changes to registers, memory, etc. You know, what do they do in the sense of, like, what are their effects that we can observe in our program? So not included, so notably not included is, how fast is anything? That is not. Yeah, so that is something the compiler might care about, but not a correctness thing. So how fast it is, not part of this. Just like, what instructions are there, not whether which ones are better than others, just what instructions are there, how do you use them, how do you make machine code for them. So the microarchitecture is a, you know, particular hardware implementation. And there are, you know, always multiple, you know, many possible microarchitectures to implement a particular ISA. So this is where we decide how fast instructions are. You know, so decide how fast instructions are, you know, whether how is your register file designed, you know, do and so on. So as an example, we've seen the single cycle plus the pipeline design, the beginnings of the pipeline design. And these are two different microarchitectures that implement the same ISA. So we have these two microarchitectures that can implement Y86. And they execute instructions in a different amount of time. The pipeline one takes more time to execute each instruction. And we've implied that it finishes one instruction per cycle, but there are some exceptions to that, as we'll learn about when we think about instructions like conditional jumps. Like, we can't do that. We mentioned we had that problem with fetch, where we assume you could figure out what to fetch right away, and that was not actually a thing we can do. So we'll learn that not all instructions take one cycle in that, so that takes a variable amount of time, and it depends which instructions. So we've made a bunch of decisions where we've changed the performance of the instructions and dramatically changed how they're implemented. But the assembly is the same as far as writing a correct compiler and assembler. You just need to know it's Y86. You don't care if it's single cycle or multi-cycle. Yeah?
So could a single HCL file be considered a microarchitecture?
So the question, single HCL file is be considered a microarchitecture? It's specifying a microarchitecture, yeah. Yeah, so the microarchitecture is sort of like specified by something like HCL code, and this is specified, specification like in our textbook of like what's the machine code look like, what do instructions look like. And that specification, yeah, the most important thing is it doesn't make decisions about how fast things are, how efficient things are. Doesn't decide, therefore, like where you store things, for example. Like, we have registers in our instructions. That doesn't mean they're actually stored in a register file. We could do other things as long as you can't notice. Like, we could store them in memory and like take lots of cycles to get them. That would be a correct implementation, a different microarchitecture. But for the same instruction set, as long as the instructions don't change. So we can do all sorts of crazy things to implement the same instructions, and it's just a different microarchitecture. It's still the same instruction set architecture. And this happens with real instruction sets, because, for example, x86, there's some instructions that maybe we don't really care about very much. So maybe they're now slow, because we don't care about them, but we haven't gotten rid of them because it's still the same, we still support the same instruction set architecture. So single cycle is, one cycle per instruction. Pipelined is multiple cycles per instruction. Most of the time, one instruction completes per cycle, but not always. So these are examples of differences that are microarchitecture differences. And we might have other differences, like you might make a microarchitecture where, despite needing to read two registers for an instruction, you have a one-port register file. And take every instruction, take multiple cycles to run to deal with that. And that's fine. As long as you can still figure out how to implement the same instruction set, the same machine code. Yeah. So how does what? Any of what? Endianness? So endianness has to do with, so the question is, what is endianness as far as the points we have? So endianness has to do with what does machine code look like? Because we had cases where we had a constant machine code. We know it was a series of bytes. We had to specify which byte is which. So that's where endianness comes in. Another place is where it comes in is, what do the instructions do? When you use an instruction that loads a particular, starting at a particular byte and storing at a particular byte, what happens? Endianness comes in there. So it's all part of the instruction set architecture for that reason. Yeah?
When we see capital SEQ, what is that?
So question is, what is capital SEQ on old exams? That's how we refer to the single cycle processor described in our textbook. Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Give an example of a instruction that's not completed in one cycle.
What?
Can you like give an example of like an instruction that's not like completed in one cycle, you know, pipeline microarchitecture?
So in a pipeline architecture, so we didn't go through any examples in detail. We'll do a lot more of this after this exam. But one thing we previewed is when we talked about combining fetch and PC update, we mentioned this seems problematic for conditional jumps. We don't have the condition evaluated yet. So that's going to be an example where the effective time the instruction takes is sometimes going to result in us not completing one instruction every cycle. And we'll learn exactly how that works later on. For now, it's just important. The important thing to know is that it's going to end up varying with these different microarchitectures, whether we can do one instruction per cycle or not. And that's a design choice. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. I will add that to a later topic, since that's not extremely related to where we are now. Okay, so the HCL register question on the latest quiz, which I initially miskeyed, which was, let's just look it up. I initially keyed this as 4 instead of 5, which was a mistake. Because you could have done the question by actually running this HCL code by adding enough so it compiles, which is what I should have done when checking my key, rather than assuming that what I had worked out on paper didn't have some sort of mistake. So this was the code. So, and we said, and the question said, cycle 0, we had y foo equals y bar equals 1, which are the initial values. So that's what's going to happen during initial time. And in the question, I used cycle 0 just to be clear how we're numbering cycles, because there's multiple ways you could do that. So if we think about what this means, that we have x foo during cycle 0 equals 1 plus 1. We have x bar equals x foo plus 1, which is the same as 2, 1 plus 1 plus 1, which is 3. And this means during cycle 1, remember what our registers do is they copy their inputs to their outputs after each rising edge of the clock, and we had a rising edge of the clock between these two. So we have y foo equals old x foo, which is 1 plus 1, so 2. And we have y bar equals owed x bar, which was 3. And we can say what was x foo? X foo is y foo plus y bar, so 2 plus 3, which is 5. In this cycle, x bar, which remembers the inputs to this register, is going to be x foo plus 1, which is 5 plus 1, which is 6. And then we have a rising edge of the clock, and the question asks what y foo was during cycle 2. So we're at cycle 2, we have y foo equals the old x foo, which was 5. And then we're done. We could also figure out what happens during cycle 2, but I don't actually need that information. So questions about how I figure things out here? So I guess, you know, rising edge of the clock, this copies register inputs, x foo x bar to outputs y foo y bar, and then we evaluate everything here. I happen to do things in order, but if, for example, I had taken this code and swapped these two lines, it would have the same effect because, remember, order doesn't matter. We just look for the value from the current cycle, looking wherever we need to look. Okay, so questions on figure this out? And I had it miskeyed for 3 hours. I'm sorry.
Do we still have 1-1 in both registers in cycle 0?
Yeah, because that's their output. Remember, what's in the register is what they're outputting. What's coming into their input is not stored in them until the rising edge of the clock tells it to store a new value. Yes? So the question is like, here, why was I using X foo from this cycle?
Yeah, so like in cycle 0, when you calculate X bar, you use 1 plus 1 until you X foo, and so instead of using X foo, just 1, so you're using, I guess, your calculation.
So the question is, yeah, why am I using, let's start with this cycle, why is X foo here 2? Not 1. So one thing that might be helpful for thinking about this is a wire or a signal, wire in HCL, only has one value during a cycle. So if you're ever tempted to say it has two values, it doesn't. So the first problem we should say is that it's either 2 or 1 during cycle 0, it's not both. And the other way of thinking about it is that the only thing we learn about that registers do for us is they set their outputs. Everything else we have to figure out how the assignments of wires to other wires, the connections work for everything else. Only the outputs is where we start, and the Y values are the outputs. Does that clear things up?
Yes.
Yeah?
Would it have been possible to use X bar to compute X foo?
Would it have been possible to use X bar to compute X foo? Yes, so long as we didn't create a cycle. If you create a cycle, that's a problem. If you try to compile that in HCL or REST, you'll get an error. If you try to build that circuit, if you remember our adding circuit, which had a loop, and we had this indeterminate values where values were changing, so it won't work. Other questions? Okay, next question is on RARB bit indexing. So there's a couple ways of thinking about this. So one is that in HCLRS, since we, since we read from memory in a little endian, the least significant byte is address plus 0, where the address we read from plus zero, the second least significant byte is plus 1, and so on. So that's just because of how Lydian works. And in HCLRS, we number bits starting at the least significant bit. So bits 0 through 7 inclusive of a number are the least significant byte. Bits 8 through 15 inclusive are the second least significant byte, and so on. So one way of thinking about extracting RARB given this is that we have I10 bytes, which is the number from memory, and the byte containing RA and RB is the second least significant byte, because the first one is the opcode function CC byte. So if we think, so we can extract this using 0.8. And then once we have that, we say, oh, that the number, if we think about OXRARB means RA is the most significant 4 bits, and RB is the least significant 4 bits. So the RA is the most significant 4 bits, but which means that the highest numbered, so this is least significant, just like with our bytes, least significant started with 0, so this is 0 to 3 inclusive. It's 0 to 3 inclusive within HCLRS. We could have numbered them differently, but that's not how HCLRS numbers them. Like, you're not crazy for wanting them to be lower, but that's not the choice we made. Is 0 is least significant always. And this is bits, therefore, 4 to 7 inclusive. So RA for the byte containing RA and RB, we do this two-step extraction, is 4.8 and not 0.4. And if we say, oh, I'm extracting some bits and then extracting some bits of those, I can do that in one step. Oh, I'm sorry. I made a mistake here that no one pointed out. Okay, so we get the byte containing RA and RB is 8 through 16 because it's bits 8 through 15 inclusive. 8 through 16 is how we specify that in HCLRS. And then RA is 4 through 8 of that. Yeah. So 8 through 16, remember, the least significant byte, which would be 0 through 7, is where the opcode and the function code and the condition code are. And we're talking about extracting the registers. Right. So that's our two-step process, and we could also, you know, this is the same as RA equals I10 bytes 12, 16, the 4 through 8 of starting at 8. Yeah?
So all the bytes are ordered the same way as assembly, but all the nibbles are reversed.
So if you write it out in English order, yes. So the other thing I would point out is that maybe our instruction table is just written the wrong way. That we could have written our instruction table. So our instruction table has this sort of inconsistency where our bit numbering goes 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, and then 8, and then 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, this is our bit numbering when we think about having, op, and then FN, and then RA, and then RB. This is what our instruction encoding table looks like as far as if you think of how are the bits numbered. You have 0, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, 15, 14, 13, 12, as far as what's written left to right. We could have written it where we write in the other way, where we just say, I'm going to put 0 over on this side. So our machine code table may be written in a weird order for bit numbering. It makes sense for decoding manually. We could have written differently, where we say, this is where byte 0 is, so we have 4, 3, 3, 2, 1, and 7, 6, 5, for, and then where we write the op and fn, and then rb. And have this be, have 8, 9, 10, 11, and so on. Sorry. Yeah, we could have written it that kind of way. We're in reverse, which matches the bit ordering better, but it's less intuitive when you're decoding things by hand. Any other questions on this? Okay. So, otherwise, we have our instruction stages. So, we have sort of two kinds of stages we talked about. We have sort of our, you know, fake slash conceptual stages with our single cycle processor, where this is just how our textbook divided up the components of our, how our textbook divided up the components of the processor. We had our real stages with our pipeline processor, where stages are separated by pipeline registers, and instructions are sent from one stage to the other using these. So an instruction doesn't advance to the next stage until the clock signal rises. And the stages we had were sort of fetch, which is read the instruction memory, and split up instruction into pieces, and compute length of instruction plus address of following instruction. That's what we did in our, that's what our textbook called the fetch stage. And we had decode, which was read the register file. Despite the name, you would think the name involves splitting up the instruction. That's just not the choice our textbook made, not because it's a good choice, just because they did that. Then we had execute, which is use the ALU to compute anything relevant, which is for add sub XOR, the new value, and for memory instructions, you know, the memory address we need. Then we had memory, which was use the data memory, and we had write back, which was set up the register file write. And we also had, for single cycle only, PC update, which is change the PC, and for pipelined, that we did that also update the PC. PC, so fetch can happen immediately. So next fetch can happen right away. And I guess I should note that there are cases where you won't be able to do this. To do this, just after the exam. Okay, so questions on stages? Some more specific inquiries? Yeah. So if I'm given an instruction, I need to break it up into the stages. So what do we want to find out about the stages of this instruction? Like so the order things would happen. So for our single cycle processor, the stages actually tell us nothing about the order things happen in. What we care about is what's connected to what. Like physical dependencies or whatnot. So for updates, we know that the components we've talked about only do updates at a rising edge of a clock, so the question is, when's the rising edge of the clock going to be for our single cycle? And for reads, like the register file can't read the right register until it has the register number. The data memory can't read the right memory location until it has the address. So there's those ordering constraints where like we just can't do it early enough unless we have some magical way of guessing what the value would be. So there will be those ordering constraints, and that's how you look at it. The stages might help you remember what the components are and how they're connected to each other, and often will correspond to the order, but for the single cycle, what determines it is how things are connected. So for example, let's say we had a memory stage, but the memory could take the input directly from the register file as far as for its address. Then the memory could act at the same time as execute as the ALU in that single cycle design because it has the value, it's gonna start working. Now in our pipeline processor, we know the stages are separated by pipeline registers, so you look at the instruction and you say, we have to get the right things in the pipeline registers before we can go on to the next stage. We know that has a rising edge of the clock, so we can just count how many rising edges of the clock need to happen before this can happen, and you'll have an ordering from that. Yeah?
Should we know how to do all the hardware stuff? Like, design the hardware? How we went over from different hardware connections and whatnot? How detailed do we know that stuff?
You should be able, we don't expect you to memorize, real details of the textbook design, but you should be able to figure something out. You should know how our register file and memories work. You should understand, if I ask you what should the ALU be connected to, you should be able to tell me that. If I ask you what should the data memory be connected to, you should be able to tell me that. That sort of thing. You should be able to tell me if I have a MUX, what should it be doing? In a general sense, but we're not going to try to ask questions which are about things where there are multiple choices in how to do things. Like we had the example of how to do IR move Q, our textbook add zero, and you could shortcut the value. We're not going to ask about that sort of case. We don't need to memorize those kinds of decisions, but we're going to need to figure out how to produce a correct single cycle processor. Yeah.
So you just gave an example of specific type of wiring in which the write back would execute at the same time as the execute stage.
The memory would, yeah.
Yeah, so when answering questions, we shouldn't assume about how things are wired up. Is that what you're getting?
So when answering questions, so to know how things happen in the instruction, you should think about what needs to happen for this instruction to work. So for example, for our memory instructions, for memory moves, you know that connection is not possible because you can't just take the register output and use it because you know it has a displacement. So you know something needs to add that first. So that would be how you know that wouldn't be possible, not by memorizing the wiring or textbook use necessarily. Okay, other questions? Timing, pipeline, and single cycle. So the general rule is the critical path rule, which is the longest path determines the longest path from state to state, usually, e.g. pipeline register to pipeline register, register to pipeline register, or register to register to memory write or register file write determines the cycle time. And we need the longest path because all the paths are going to happen all at once, and we need all of them to finish before our cycle finishes, or else things will be in a weird state. So happen at once, need enough time for all to finish. So for a single cycle, the path, the longest path probably goes from the PC to some, to, you know, the to memory, some memory or register file. Like, goes all the way through the processor. For a pipeline, the longest path is probably goes from pipeline register to something, or something to pipeline register. Register, you know, it's the IE longest path equals the worst stage. So all the stages need to happen at once for different instructions. We need enough time for the longest one and to happen. And that determines our cycle time for the pipeline processor. And for our pipeline processor, you know, each instruction needs to go through every stage. So this means that you'll have this sort of train of instructions, so that if I have, say, my fetch decode execute write back pipeline, I'll have instruction A will be in fetch during time 0, and then it will be in decode, then it will be in execute, then it will be in write back. And while this is happening during the next cycle, assuming we can fetch the next instruction right away, we'll have instruction B in fetch, then decode, then write back, then instruction C, and so on. And if we look at what this timeline ends up looking like, you can see that we take that between the A finishes after at time 3, at the end of time cycle 3, and then B, then C, and so on. And so this is, you know, this is, I should say, this should be time, this is, should be cycle. And the amount of time each cycle will take So the amount of time per cycle is based on, is the critical path. Critical path, the number of cycles is as above. So this gets us to our latency versus throughput a bit. But so any questions so far? So this timeline, so this is how we count cycles with our pipeline processor, but the amount of time per cycle is going to be determined by the critical path, namely, which is going to be basically the slowest stage. Yeah?
Whenever you say in a pipeline register how it goes from a pipeline register to something, wouldn't that something be like the next pipeline register?
It will often be the next pipeline register, yes. Not always, like if you think of write back, it doesn't work that way. But will often be the next pipeline register, yes. Slowest stage. So, talked about latency and throughput. So the latency, so for instruction A, the latency of instruction A is the time from when instruction A starts to when it finishes. So latency is time from start to finish. So for an instruction, that's the time from when we start the instruction in our pipeline processor, for example, to when we finish it, which in this case is 4 cycles, or if we wanted to measure it as an actual time, because we know the amount of time per clock cycle might vary, we need to look at that critical path, find out what's the slowest stage, and that determines our latency. Our throughput is going to be the time between finishing instructions, or which is going to be equal to the time between starting instructions, because we're going to ignore startup and finishing. So yeah, I know we don't finish our first instruction until here. We're going to assume we have enough work that that's not significant when we're talking about throughput. Throughput is about sort of long-term what's going on. So here, the throughput time from start to finish. So if we say, so e.g. with 200 picosecond cycle, above we have about 2 second cycle, A has a latency of 4 times 200 equals 800 picoseconds, and that 200 picosecond cycle determined by the slowest stage. Our throughput, e.g. above, one instruction per cycle plus 200 picoseconds a cycle equals one instruction every 200 picoseconds is our throughput, or 5 instructions a nanosecond. Okay, and so questions on throughput latency? I'm surprised I'm actually almost using my time. Okay, so then we have the question on the quiz, which is about doubling the number of stages, assuming it made sense to do, and how that affects throughput and latency. So if we think of doubling the number of stages, we're going to, ideally, this will, probably we finish about one instruction per cycle still before, and we finish about one instruction per cycle after that. We're assuming that we just, that's typically what we do. We'll talk after the exam about like how realistic is that, but that's a reasonable starting point, and you don't need to actually think about whether that changes for this question. Then we think about latency, and this is determined by the slowest stage. So the question is, how slow is the slowest stage gonna be? And so if the slowest stage takes half the time, then we double the throughput. So if the slowest stage takes half the time, we double the throughput. So the question is, can we do that? So in order to take half the time, we're going to need to divide up, but to do that, we need to divide up an existing stage exactly in half. We divide up the existing slowest stage exactly in half, and not have to worry about an extra pipeline register. Sure, and both of these are problematic. We probably can't divide it exactly in half, and we definitely are going to need to add a pipeline register to separate the two halves. So probably can't do this. Can't divide stage exactly in half, maybe. Definitely need to add pipeline register, which is going to take some amount of time, which means that we're not going to split into two stages which take half the time, that we're going to have take our, so stage that took XPS now takes X divided by 2 plus pipeline register, pipeline register related extra. So we have some extra time because we have that pipeline register which didn't change when we divided up the stage. We didn't actually divide the pipeline register in half, so we have a little extra time, which means we didn't actually divide it in half as far as the work. So it's going to be a little slower than that, which means that our latency is going to increase because now our stage, our cycle time is a little higher, and we have twice as many, the cycle time is a little more than half, and we have twice as many cycles, so that's a little more than twice latency. Not more than twice, but it's a little more latency. So it's going to increase, but probably not going to double. Like, we're adding proportional to the pipeline register delay, not like doubling the amount of time. Like, we're reducing the time per cycle. But our throughput's not going to double because we can't actually divide things actually in half because of the pipeline register. So a way we can visualize this is we had our, you know, original stage, we had our reg, and then computation, and we end up with our new stages. We have our pipeline reg, we have compute part one, and we have compute part two, but we need a pipeline register between them. So we add that extra cost. And that's where we end up with. It's still, you know, if our compute is a little more realistic as far as the ratio between the compute and the pipeline register, because we said it was sensible, like, you know, with something like that, it's still going to give us a throughput gain, but it's going to make things have higher latency because latency is going through all these steps, all these extra pipeline registers. And it's not going to be like splitting in half and getting half the time. Other questions about this? Okay, so then we have a question on register updates in single cycle. Was that what someone was looking for in our last 2 minutes? So the way to think about as far as what register updates happen are we prepare during the cycle, we prepare all of the values we need on the inputs we change on the inputs to register to the PC register file data memory. So during the cycle, those will be set, and you can work backwards for how they must be set. So if you say, oh, the data memory needs to change a value, that means that now I need the input for the data to come from the right place, and if it comes from a register, comes from the register file, I can work backwards from that to figure out what's the value there. If it's like computed by the ALU, I say, well, we have to add these two numbers to compute an address, therefore those must be the inputs to the ALU, and we can work backwards, figure out what all the wires are set. This is how I would think about that type of problem. I say, what needs to actually happen? And let's work backwards from our data memory, our PC register, and our register file to figure out where do those inputs come from until we get to our, you know, original state elements. Okay, so that's what I have for today. So Wednesday will be exam review in lab, so TAs will be there to answer questions that you might have that weren't answered here that you come up with. Please take advantage of it. And that's all I have for